good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 525 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. Last week's show, of course, we looked at toxic chemicals and the effect that they had going way beyond what was anticipated, concluding with the possibly rather depressing thought that in the modern economic environment, preventing cancer is not any kind of financial priority for companies, especially those which are invested in the cancer treatment industry. Now, that was a rather depressing thought, so I thought this week, to redress the balance, I'd look not at man-made toxic chemicals, but at naturally occurring medicines. And one jumped out at me, which was cannabis. In our second hour, which is the bigger picture talk of the show this week, we're going to be hearing from Michael Pollan, who was speaking about food in episode 516, who also is a theorist about cannabis. He's going to be speaking about how that particular plant affects the human mind, about how it may have affected societies, and it contains some speculative, but I think very thought-provoking content. And he begins his talk with a new take on evolution, very much along the lines of Charles Eisenstein, a co-evolution of different organisms, different ideas, different cultures. It's a well-introduced talk, so I'll let that stand alone. But our first hour is made up of a single talk. This is by Claudia Little, who is introduced in the talk itself, but I should let you know that she's speaking to a group of people at a medical marijuana clinic. So it may not be a completely objective overview of the state of medical marijuana research. If there is much in the way of negative findings about cannabis use, then she doesn't present it here. Nevertheless, I thought it was a very interesting, fact-filled talk. It's from March this year, and it has quite a lot on up-to-date research that I'd never heard about. Even the thought that cannabis is, in some cases, working as an anti-carcinogen, which would seem to be very counterintuitive, considering if you smoke it, you think that would affect the body in the same way as smoking tobacco. Well, even that might not be true. Considering how many shows we've had on the drug war, regular listeners will know that the information in the public sphere on drug use is not objective by any means, and to illustrate the point, she cites a spokesman from NIDA from earlier this year, who said, quote, "As the National Institute of Drug Abuse, our focus is primarily on the negative consequence of marijuana use. We generally do not fund research focused on the potential beneficial effects of marijuana," unquote. So, the US NIDA has a large budget devoted to finding evidence of why marijuana is bad. There's no such large organization devoted to finding evidence of its beneficial effects. Some of the studies that she cites are research which the NIDA funded with the initial thought this will show cannabis is harmful, but which turned out to have the opposite result, and to the credit of the people who did the research, they went ahead and published it anyway, in spite of possible repercussions. So we're back to the state of inspired individuals following what they believe to be right, rather than following twisted institutional agendas. Now let's hear Claudia Little.
Well, hi. I haven't done one of these classes before, so you're my guinea pigs here. Everything I talk about, you'll be able to access with links to all kinds of studies. So if anything especially piques your interest, you'll find it listed here, and you can really delve into it a lot deeper. If you want, I'll send each of you a copy to these links. So anyway, I'm 64, I'm a grandma, and I'm an outspoken medical marijuana activist. So what happens to make somebody like me really get up and speak before city council people and to the media, which I used to do in San Diego before we moved up here a few years ago? It's almost always some kind of personal incident that causes somebody to really get passionate. So I'm just going to go through a little of my personal history to kind of tell you where I'm coming from on that. I went to college in the 60s. So, you know, a lot of people were, you know, loved children then, and we had flowers in our hair and all that. Although I didn't. I was really a straight, you know, laced kind of person. And I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 67. And then I went right into the Navy Nurse Corps as an officer. You know, I'd tried smoking cannabis in college. I'd had a joint and didn't really have any feeling from it. You know, I think a lot of us had that experience the first time we tried cannabis. As an officer, of course, that wasn't part of my lifestyle, so, you know, just kind of passed me by. But Vietnam War, I mean, I joined the nurse corps, and it was like, I wasn't for the war, but they were helping me get through school. So anyway, after I got out of the nurse corps, I worked for a while and then got a master's of public health from Tulane University. And decided after that I really wanted to be a nurse practitioner. So I did get a certification as a nurse practitioner from UC San Francisco. And worked then for a while, got married, had a child, got divorced, raised my kid till he was getting in close to high school. And then I met Ron Little right over here, my wonderful husband. And that was in the mid-90s. And about that time, I was still working, and I was coming home from a long drive, and I got a call from my kid's high school, and he had just been arrested on campus with a joint, and so he was going to get suspended, and he wasn't going to be able to go back to school unless he went to a couple of drug rehab programs. He was brand new in this school because we just moved to the area. He was a freshman, and it was the most horrible kind of introduction to his new group of friends, and then going to the cannabis or the marijuana rehab program was just quite an eye-opener for my husband and I. We sat through these things with our son, you know, trying to look very stoic about being, you know, you can't be doing this kind of thing, knowing that what they were telling our son was completely erroneous, and it really pissed us off. So by this time, you know, we had actually, we smoked cannabis now and then at home, but very seldom. I mean, Ron and I had decided to get married before we'd even discussed whether we smoked cannabis, so that's how infrequent it was. But that really galvanized both of us to learn more about marijuana because we knew what they were telling our kid was wrong. So we actually signed up to go to a normal conference in San Francisco. And this was in the early 2000s, you know, around 2002 or so. At that point, we were still so under the radar. Our friends didn't know we ever smoked at all, and we just kind of crept off to San Francisco, not telling anyone where we were. And we got to this conference, and if you haven't ever gone to a national conference of one of the advocacy groups, I'd really, really recommend that you do. It totally changed us. We went there, and we saw people getting up, famous people. Rick Steves, you know, the travel guy, he's on the board of Normal. He got up and gave an impassioned talk about how cannabis should be legalized for all purposes.
One of my goals is to bring him.
He is so fabulous. Yeah, he's a great guy. And, you know, lots of lectures on the medical uses and a lot of people getting up and talking about all aspects. What really got me interested, though, is this talk by some Americans for Safe Access people. They just started the Americans for Safe Access chapter in San Francisco. And we were so impressed with what they were doing that when we came back to San Diego, we joined with a couple of other people that we'd met from the area, and we actually started an Americans for Safe Access chapter. And right away, that really propelled us into the limelight. And I haven't been sorry at all. And I'm really, really just so pleased to be able to know as much as I do about cannabis and actually now to tell you a little bit about it, too. I think that, like I said, the pivotal thing for me was keeping my son safe. In my case, it was keeping him safe from arrest. And I think that's the biggest thing that we all need to do. And, you know, the cannabis prohibition is, that is the main problem with it. Not cannabis, the plant, but the prohibition of cannabis. About 4,000 years ago, cannabis was mentioned in the Chinese pharmacopoeia. It said it undoes rheumatism. So this is something that's been known for millennia. And as we've come forward, and even in our own country in the 1600s, it was actually illegal not to grow cannabis. You had to grow it. And by 1850, there were over 8,000 cannabis plantations, or I guess they'd call it hemp back then, hemp plantations in the U.S., and a plantation was 2,000 acres. So it was a huge crop, and our whole economy depended on it. By the time we get into the early 1900s, the slaves have been emancipated, and the Mexicans are starting to come across into southern states, and they brought their cannabis with them for medicinal value as well as recreational value. And the fact that these black and brown people, jazz musicians in New Orleans, were using it, and that culture kind of expanded the use of cannabis in a group of people that our country at the time was very much afraid of. And the politicians of the time that wanted to really get rid of the hemp-growing people of our nation, because like William Randolph Hearst wanted to make newspapers out of his forests, and the DuPonts wanted to make nylon and rayon instead of having hemp fibers, all of this kind of conspired to get rid of hemp in the country. And so around in the 30s, the first Federal Narcotics Bureau was formed, and actually now it's morphed into the DEA. But they got together with some of these tycoons, the politicians did, and in the back doors, they decided they were going to tax marijuana, and they were calling it marijuana. So the pharmaceutical companies that had cannabis in most of their patent medicines at the time, and who else? The farmers that were growing hemp, they called it hemp. So when they were talking about this demon weed called marijuana, you know, people didn't really recognize what they were doing. About 2 days before the Senate or the Congress was going to vote on the Tax Act, the AMA came and realized, hey, this is cannabis. We can't let this happen. And they came to testify in Congress, and their testimony was actually misrepresented to Congress. And 2 days later, it was just too late to stop it. The Tax Act was passed. And that essentially made cannabis illegal. That was really the only way the federal government could do it, because usually states had to regulate their drugs. So the Tax Act made anyone that sold marijuana, they had to pay a huge tax, and of course nobody could pay it, and so that made them go to jail. It worked. And the hysteria that surrounded cannabis back then was really unforgivable, and the kinds of prejudice-type statements that were made really couldn't be made today. But here's what Harry Anslinger said, the first director of our Narcotics Bureau. He said, there are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana use. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and all others. So that's the kind of stuff that was fed to the public, and it just kept on going. And cannabis use really kind of died out a bit. But around the 60s, when I was in college, it had a resurgence. And most of us that are in this age group know that there's nothing wrong with cannabis. Most of us didn't really get very high from it even, you know, so who cares? Science has been trying to inform politicians for a long time that they're off base. Nixon even commissioned the Schaefer Report in 72, and the Schaefer Report reported back to him saying, the criminal law is too harsh a tool to apply to personal possession, even in an effort to discourage use. It implies an overwhelming indictment of the behavior which we believe is not appropriate. The actual and potential harm of use of the drug is not great enough to justify intrusion by the criminal law into private behavior, a step which our society takes only with the greatest reluctance. So Nixon got the report, totally ignored it, went forward with the drug war. In 1988, the DEA's own administrative law judge, and you've probably, a lot of you heard this, he actually told the DEA head, marijuana in its natural forms is one of the safest therapeutically active substances known to man. And this was based on a lot of science that was was accumulated at the time and summarized by the law judge to his boss. That was ignored. As late as 1999, the Institutes of Medicine on a federal level gave the report saying, and they affirmed that marijuana and its constituents possessed numerous therapeutic properties, including the ability to control pain, nausea, and anxiety, and to stimulate appetite. So you can see that all the scientific information that we'll be talking about today falls on deaf ears. So when any of you hear marijuana has no medicinal benefit, after today, I hope that you'll be able to really speak out very vociferously about it and maybe send them some of the links that I'm going to share with you. Polls have shown that 80% of the population of our country believe that medical cannabis should be legalized, and that's everybody, all the states. We have now medical cannabis laws in 14 states, and if you want to know what they are, I can let you know. But our advocacy groups and our lobbying groups in Washington are constantly going and talking with state leaders and federal leaders, and that's why we have these laws. It's not because the states just decided, hey, this is a good idea. So that's one reason I'm going to make a big pitch for joining all the different advocacy groups and checking their websites routinely, because every week there's a new action alert. And I was on a conference call just this week with Americans for Safe Access, calling from the Capitol building in between appointments with senators. And they have said, you know, we go and talk to them, but we need the constituents out there to be making a loud noise to their congresspeople. They need to know that you are behind us. Something that's just, you know, this has been around for a while, but maybe a lot of you don't know, that a lot of organizations, medical and scientific organizations, over the last 10 or so years have been calling for the legalization of cannabis for medical purposes. And here in the U.S., just to name a couple, I mean, this is pages and pages of both in our country and in other countries. But here in the U.S., the American Academy of Family Physicians has endorsed immediate legal access. The American Nurses Association, the American Public Health Association, and most impressively and most exciting for me is that the American Medical Association, the AMA, in November just called for rescheduling of cannabis and endorsing its therapeutic value. And this was just in November, and I have to, I'm actually on the medical advisory board for Americans for Safe Access, and one of my fellow members is a member of the AMA. And he's the one that actually got this resolution passed. So you can see that these advocacy groups have a tremendous influence on what's happening in our country. And I'm really, really happy about that. This is another thing that you'll find on your list of links. And this is a beautiful compendium of information on recent research. This is all research that's been done in the last 10 years. On medical cannabis, and you can see just from the diagram here lots of different ways that it's used. This is the kind of thing that you can print out and take to your doctor, especially the ones that don't think there's, you know, think this is all mumbo jumbo. The organizations here, I mean, well, the literature that's listed in here is all annotated, and they can look up the references. And if they look at it online, they're all links that you don't have to really go anywhere. They're just right there for you. You're being spoon-fed, so it's beautiful. The reason that a lot of physicians don't believe in cannabis as being a therapeutic and don't want to get involved is, well, for one thing, they're afraid. On your links, you'll see that there's reference to Conant versus Walters, which was a court case that came about in 2003. And it went as far as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So in that decision, it was the doctor's right to recommend cannabis was upheld. The Supreme Court refused to take the case. So it's definitely something that your physicians can do. And if they think they are going to get in trouble or whatever, you can just take a copy of that to them, and it should allay any kind of fears that they have. The science of cannabis is very young. We didn't even know what the active ingredient of THC was until 1964. And it was researched and discovered by a lab in Israel from the University of Jerusalem. And that lab is still very active today, and they do an awful lot of research on cannabis. So in 64, we knew what the active ingredient was, and we knew that it caused some kind of a psychoactive response in our body. So there must be some kind of receptor in our body that responded to this external cannabinoid. So the search was on to find those receptors. And it wasn't until 1988 that the CB1 receptor was found, which is in the brain. And it's all throughout the brain and the central nervous system. And this little diagram shows a lot of different areas in the brain and what they control. So a lot of the psychoactive and even some of the therapeutic aspects of cannabis are controlled from the brainstem. And that CB1 receptor was found, and that is mostly in the central nervous system. But if we didn't know until a couple of years later about the CB2 receptor, which is in the immune system. So the hunt was on for, if we've got this receptor that this external cannabinoid works with and causes a psychoactive response and other responses too, then there must be something our body produces that link up to this, or why would we have a receptor? But it wasn't until 1992, that's not very long ago, that our own internal cannabis-like substance was found, and they called it anandamide, and that's Sanskrit for bliss, which is really appropriate. It was a couple of years after that, at UC Irvine, that a second endocannabinoid was discovered, and that has a really long name that people have shortened to 2-AG. So we know that we have two internal cannabinoids, and it's suspected that there are at least a couple more, but they have not been actually identified yet. We know they're there, but it'll probably be a few more years until we find those. But people are definitely actively looking for these endocannabinoids. There are lots of different cannabinoids in the plant. The plant has about 60 cannabinoids. So very simply how it works in our body is that when we have pain or nausea or all the other things that cause dysphoria in our bodies, our internal cannabinoids are activated, and they're really trying to overcome that. And eventually, you know, most of us do get some relief from our pain or our nausea or whatever. That is our endocannabinoid system. So when you take external cannabinoids and you smoke or eat or whatever, that augments the system and the effect is amplified. So in most cases, people find that if they, you know, let's just take mood, for instance. You know, if you smoke cannabis, your mood is elevated. That just amplifies the whole endocannabinoid kind of system that we have. In our country, we have a really reductionist attitude toward medicines. Most of our, actually not, maybe not most, but a good percentage of our medicines are plant-based. Aspirin for one, digoxin, atropine, morphine, vincristine, and Taxol for chemotherapeutics. You could go on and on. And how we work things in America is that we identify the active ingredient. The pharmaceutical companies then synthesize it in a lab. They put it into some kind of pill form or injectable. They concentrate it so it's really strong, and then they patent it, and then you get it as prescribed pharmaceutical. This is a really different approach than Eastern medicine. And a couple of years ago, Ron and I went to Vancouver, and Chinatown was really interesting, and they have a couple of pharmacies there. And we were just blown away walking around Vancouver in this pharmacy looking at jars, big jars of roots and leaves and all kinds of mushrooms and different kinds of things. And people were in there buying those things and from a doctor's prescription. So those are whole plant medicinals. There are far less side effects with whole plant medicinals. There's a synergy that happens when you use whole plant. And most people that are using cannabis, a lot of times you'll hear the argument, well, we need it to be FDA approved, and, you know, why are they having to smoke it when they can use Marinol? In fact, there is actually an initiative circulating signatures right now to outlaw our cannabis law here. I don't know if any of you are aware of that, but they want to say, okay, well, we recognize the medicinal aspects of Marinol. It's actually a class 3 drug, which is not highly regulated like a class 1 is, which is considered the most dangerous. They've allowed Marinol to be a class 3 and prescribed by a doctor. Most patients that have tried it don't really like it because it's unopposed THC. And unopposed THC causes anxiety and paranoia and agitation, and it's just not very comfortable.
It doesn't have cannabinoids either, does it? That
is a cannabinoid, yes. THC is a cannabinoid, yes. And it's a psychoactive, it's the psychoactive cannabinoid. The plant has a lot of different cannabinoids in it, in addition to THC. Yeah, good question.
Can I share a quick story?
Sure.
I went to Mexico, and the reason I initially started doing it, I would break into hives and just alert, have chemical sensitivity.
Yeah.
And I'd have to go get injections of steroids every month, and a friend of mine suggested I try marijuana, and as I was getting the hives, I did, and they went away. And it, we kept watching the cycle. Every time I'd get it, I'd try it. And so I worked with my doctor for a year, and we noticed there was literally no explanation for it other than that. So I was going to Mexico, and she gave me a prescription of Marinol.
Oh.
Well, I took it down there, and I got hives while I was taking Marinol. And fortunately, we were staying with a Hispanic family who had a teenager, and I had my teenage daughter goes, "Mom, I can get you some, right?" So her boyfriend goes out and gets me some, right? And I was broken into hives, and I did, and they were gone overnight.
Wow.
And it just, I mean, they're instant. I get them so bad on my face that I can't see out of my eyes. It's just horrible. But the Marinol clearly does not work the same.
You're right, and that is so interesting that you said that, because the other cannabinoid that is a very active one we know a lot about is cannabidiol, and it works on the immune system, and what you had was a histamine reaction, which is kind of an autoimmune kind of reaction. It's cannabidiol. Yeah, they call it CBD, and obviously that's the ingredient that you needed.
I have autoimmune disease, and since I've taken it, I had all my blood work was out of whack on so many different things, and my blood reports come back completely clean now.
Yeah. Well, so the CBD is not psychoactive, and yet it works with the plant to give all those wonderful other kinds of benefits, especially for all the autoimmune diseases. And it's being used in very effectively for rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease because it downregulates inflammation in a beautiful way. So that's a really great first-hand account of Marinol right there. Yeah, and besides, when you take Marinol, it's actually prescribed for nausea and vomiting. And if you're taking it orally, you're going to throw it up if you're having a bad case of that. It takes a long time to get some response from, too, because it's ingested and absorbed through the GI tract, so it's not going to work very quickly. THC does have other medicinal properties, though. It's not just that it's psychoactive. It definitely has medicinal properties as well. But unopposed THC without the other cannabinoids in it can cause some of those symptoms I talked about. Now, the research has really blossomed in especially the last 10 years. And if in 1996, when Prop 215 was passed in California, if you Googled cannabis research, you would have gotten about 250 journal articles that were published. And in 2008, if you did the same thing, you would have gotten over 2,100 journal articles. And this isn't newspaper articles and sensational articles. This isn't High Times articles. This is scientific journals that are with respected credentials from universities around the world and the U.S. It works for all kinds of symptoms, and I'll just go through a list here. Glaucoma, appetite, stimulation, nausea control, pain, all sorts of pain, especially neuropathic pain and inflammation, such as arthritis, multiple sclerosis for spasticity pain management, seizures for epilepsy and movement disorders, Alzheimer's disease, GI symptoms and problems, Tourette's, insomnia, lots of other things. They don't have depression on here. I think that's a really big one, too, that is always left off of lists. But I think all of us know how much help it gives us with elevation in mood. And the reason that it works so well in so many places is because we have these CB1 and CB2 receptors all over our bodies. It's in cartilage tissue. It's in the cardiovascular system. It's everywhere. So when people say, well, it can't work for all that stuff, okay, maybe appetite and pain, but that's about it. Well, I'm sorry. That's not the whole story. I really had to stop myself from putting all these different studies on the links list. But one of the really important ones that I think that didn't make the list was where they've bred mice that didn't have the endocannabinoid receptors. And those baby mice that are born without a cannabinoid system die. You have to have cannabinoids to thrive. You don't eat and you don't gain weight and the baby mice just completely die off. So that's why, again, that this works with so many different systems and in so many different disease states. One of the most exciting things is that not only is it good for symptom relief, but there's lots of new research in the last 10 years on its anti-cancer effects and its ability to modify disease. It's neuroprotective. We know that it can actually help nerves regenerate. So in patients with Alzheimer's, a girlfriend of mine used to be so afraid of using cannabis because her mom had Alzheimer's, and it was like, oh, I don't want to do that because I might fry my brain and get even worse. Just the opposite. Cannabis is a neuroprotectant. And they've been able to show that it grows baby mice nerve cells in their brains. In 2005, one of the most definitive studies ever done on cannabis came out of UC Los Angeles, done by Donald Tashkin, who was the darling of the National Institutes on Drug Abuse. That is the organization that funds almost all of the cannabis research in the country. And he gave his findings at a medical meeting. And what the study said is that marijuana smoking was not positively associated with cancers of the lung or upper or aerodigestive tract. Even in individuals who were heavy, heavy daily smokers, he quoted 22,000 joints in their lives. You know, he looked at people who really used a lot of it. What they found was that these patients actually had less lung cancer than non-smokers of any substance. Yeah, so at the meeting, he had to admit at the meeting that it could create a protective effect. Well, over the years, that was 2005, what I loved was in June, Tashkin actually came out with this. He said that he began his work 30 years ago. When he opposed legalization because he thought it would lead to increased use and that would lead to increased health effects. However, now he admits his decades worth of scientific research revealed the opposite conclusion. And what we found instead was no association and even a suggestion of some protective effects. Now, these are patients that were smoking it, not vaporizing it. So, you know, when you hear, well, smoking is so bad for you, quote that study. Yeah.
I've been so fascinated with that study. Did they use then did they go on to people's testimony, or did they use Nida's farm in Mississippi for the?
They didn't know where the patients got their marijuana. Okay. This was looking at 2,000 patients. Oh, actually, about 2,500 patients, based on their histories,
and they're in California, so one could assume if they did use Nida's test sample that the results might not have been the same because of the lower grade of cannabis.
That's interesting. I don't think that would have made a difference because actually there's a Department of Medical Cannabis Research. A lot of people don't know that for the last 10 years there's been this Department of Medical Cannabis Research on a UC campus in San Diego. It was funded after Prop 215 was passed, and by the state, not the feds. The state wanted to know, hey, since we passed this medical cannabis law, are people going to be getting sick? And they've actually come out with about 15 published studies, all very positive. And the director of that program recently was asked about using the government-supplied NIDA rolled cigarettes that they give out. It's only grown in one place in Mississippi. That's what they used in their studies. And he liked using it because he felt like it was standardized, and he knew, even though it was maybe not the highest grade cannabis, he knew it was one standard grade of cannabis for his studies. And actually, the studies came out with pretty good results. So
that's amazing. Mm-hmm. If you think if you use high-grade, medical-grade cannabis versus that, like, 3% mm-hmm. stuff where they mix, like, the stems and the seeds.
Right.
I know Eldie Musica, she's one of the recipients.
Right.
We've seen the tins that it comes in from the government. There's 7 government federal medical marijuana patients. So I know that eventually the studies will even be more, or one could assume that the studies might even be more positive, assuming that they have a higher...
Right, yeah. There have been a couple of really huge studies. Like Kaiser did one, and it was published in 1997, of 65,000 patients. And they asked about cannabis use and looked at mortality rates, and they found no association with the increase in mortality. So that was one of the first studies, and it was kind of revolutionary that a HMO like Kaiser would do a study like that and have so many patients and have such a good result. But it did kind of go along with another study that came out in Great Britain on a large population of patients, too. So nothing's looking too much like it's causing death and dying here. Now... What it just gets even better. I mean, I just love this because this summer there were a couple of really great studies. One that was published in August, and this one came out in Cancer Epidemiology. And it was a study that took place in Boston University and also University of Minnesota and Louisiana State University. And they were looking at head and neck squamous cell cancers. And this actually confirms some research that I'd seen quite a few years earlier on rats, but this was looking at patients, real patients, at the incidence of head and neck cancers in heavy smokers of cannabis. And they found that cannabis smokers had a 35% reduction in head and neck squamous cell cancers than non-smokers of any other substance. So that doesn't that kind of go along with what Tashkin showed us, that maybe there's a protective effect here. And especially as a nurse, I know that head and neck kinds of cancers are very common in patients that smoke tobacco and drink alcohol. Those two things go together, and the incidence of head and neck cancers are extremely high. So if cannabis smoking can give that kind of protective effect, that's a very opposite effect from tobacco. There's a study here that was done by this just came out last month, Pacific Medical Center, part of the UC system. They looked at glioma cells. Glioma is one of the most dangerous kinds of brain cancers that you can get. It's very deadly. A few years back, researchers in Spain actually injected patients that were on their last legs. They were just about gone. And because you can't do this on regular patients, but sometimes at the very end of life, patients will kind of agree to be guinea pigs. And they injected glioma cells, tumors with THC, and they found that these tumors shrank and patients had a longer lifespan. And they only did this on a few patients, but that made some medical journals. But this particular research was done in the lab. It's preclinical, and so not on patients, but they looked at being able to kill cancer cells with a combination of THC and cannabidiol, and they found a greater effect in using the combination of the two, that synergy that I was talking about. There was a New Zealand study. This was just this past summer on lung function, and they looked at patients that were lung capacity, the forced vital capacity, total lung capacity, functional residual capacity, and they compared it to people that didn't smoke any kind of tobacco. And they found that cannabis smokers had the same kind of lung function outcomes than non-smokers. So again, no chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or lung compromising with smoked cannabis too. Something that made the actual mainstream news, and I call Huffington Post mainstream news these days, it's not the only news I care to look at, but I did hear it as I was driving along. I heard it on NPR, too, that the research arm of the UC system that's down in San Diego, the Center for Medical Cannabis Research, just came out with a couple of their final studies because now they're losing their funding. It's been over 10 years that they've been going, and they have a couple of studies to wrap up. But they've used the smoked cannabis, and they reported on these two final studies that looked at neuropathic pain and the spasticity of multiple sclerosis. Oh, I know what I was going to say. They're considered gold standard type studies because they're randomized, placebo-controlled type studies. And they followed patients for quite a while. And because these are the kind of studies that the FDA always says they have, that really kind of made the news. I mean, this isn't new information to someone that's been following the research. It's been out there, and it's been written up in magazines and published and everything. But the fact that a state institution that followed all the rules came out with these positive results was really newsworthy. And on the conference call that I was on recently, last week with the ACE the People, they said, okay, you know, these people that in Colorado that have been following all the rules with their dispensaries and doing everything right have been raided by the federal government just last week. They were just raids going on, even despite our attorney general saying that he's going to honor states' medical marijuana laws. Well, we have a new DEA director. Her name is Michelle Leonhardt, and she's a real drug warrior. We're not happy that she's our new DEA director. And these raids happened right after her appointment. So the fact that this has just come out, you know, it's the government can't argue with this. Okay, NIDA didn't refund the research because NIDA won't refund anything that is going to come out with a positive outcome. The state had to fund that this kind of study. But the fact that they're still raiding people and that are using medical cannabis, and in the face of this kind of research, they just said, write a letter to your paper and, you know, ask them why they didn't report on this study. You know, they're so eager to put marijuana studies in that show negative results. Let's ask our paper. So I wrote a letter. I don't know if it'll get published, but we'll see. It might. You never know. They've actually published a couple of my letters. So
the long arm of the feds.
They are, and that's the pressure that we put on is going to make a lot of difference. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
So this thing that you're doing, Alex, is very timely. On that note, just the 28th of January, the NIDA spokesperson said this: as the National Institute on Drug Abuse, our focus is primarily on the negative consequence of marijuana use. We generally do not fund research focused on the potential beneficial medical effects of marijuana. That was just a few weeks ago. So that's why we don't see anything from our government, because they have a policy not to even go there. That's why Donald Tashkin at UCLA it was really amazing that his research was able to actually get as much publicity as it did, but it was mostly within our little group of people that want to liberate cannabis.
Let me say, mm-hmm. NIDA did fund his research with the expectation that he was going to make a positive connection between lung
exactly.
cancer and cannabis smoking. Previously, all the research had been too small of projects. This was going to be the definitive one to prove that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with the contrary result, much to their chagrin.
Exactly. Okay, so I think that the psychological effects of cannabis have been so overlooked, and none of the state programs list depression as something that cannabis can be used for. And you'll hardly ever, you know, people stay away from that. So what's wrong with euphoria? That's what I want to know. You know, I think it's very obvious to me that when I smoke or vaporize with cannabis, I feel better already. I just have a lifting of mood. And with the amount of psychoactive drugs for depression that are being pharmaceuticalized in this country, cannabis would be a really great alternative. And there are so many side effects. One of the big ones for men is impotence. And with cannabis, it's just the opposite. You know, it really enhances one's sexual life. So I just think that more and more research needs to come out about cannabis being good for mood. This was a good one. This is also going to be on your links. It's cannabis in the brain, and it goes into a lot of the science about neuroprotection. But the very first paragraphs, this recited research at the University of Saskatchewan that looked at newborn mice, and it says that the university found that the administration of cannabinoids in rats stimulated the proliferation of nerve cells in the hippocampus region of the brain and significantly reduced measures of anxiety and depression-like behavior. So, okay, if it's good for rats, I guess it's good for us too. When you see things like that, when I see any kind of thing that talks about depression being ameliorated in humans, I go right for it. So this came out in November. It was done at the University of Oslo, and it looks at the use of cannabis in neurocognitive functioning for bipolar disorder, and it showed that patients that have bipolar disorder have a greatly increased relief of symptoms. In the study also, they looked at schizophrenia, and they didn't find the same relationship there. So have many of you heard about the controversy about cannabis and schizophrenia? Well, if you haven't, you may, because that seems to be the last bastion of where the attacks are coming from. You know, with all this research about the medicinal benefits and really almost any scientific paper that you write isn't going to say anything about the negative effects of cannabis. It's kind of like the last straw that the government's going to throw at us about, you know, being cautious about using or keeping it illegal. Actually, in Great Britain, they down-regulated, they had changed the scheduling of cannabis to be more liberal, and because of some research on schizophrenia a few years ago, they made it actually more restrictive. A lot of the people that really knew the cannabis literature resigned, the whole board that had been put together to reschedule cannabis to a more liberal component actually all resigned because it was so politicized. Did you have a question?
I just want to know if there was any studies done with autism.
Not that I've seen.
There's a lot of anecdotal stuff.
Lots of anecdotal studies, right.
Autism. There's just a Good Morning America or Today Show or something. Some gal had her 10-year-old kid and it was brownies.
Yeah.
She was saying this is the best thing for his autism. You know, he can actually interact a little bit now. He's not as in conflict with himself.
That's
going to be a big thing.
That I think that really will be. I had the privilege of knowing a researcher named Claudia Jensen, an MD at USC. And she used cannabis in her practice for children that had ADD, and it was very controversial. She was actually called back to testify in Washington to the health department, or the Senate Committee on Health or whatever. But there is a huge benefit for people with ADD because, you know, they're so scattered and, you know, things are... its stimulus is coming in, and having the cannabis, it kind of down regulates all of that input and makes it easier to concentrate. This is a book called Jeffrey's Journey, and it is about a one woman's story about her child who had incredible rages, and that can happen in autism too. It doesn't really say the diagnosis, but I loved it. Andrew Weil actually gave his endorsement of this, saying, "Jeffrey's Journey is a compelling firsthand account of the successful use of medical marijuana to treat a serious behavioral disorder in a child. This engaging case report offers an honest look at conventional psychiatric medications and sheds new light on the untapped possibilities of cannabis as an alternative."
Who's the author?
Debbie Jeffries and Lorraine Jeffries. So here's the study that looked at bipolar, thought it had some benefit, and looked at schizophrenia, didn't think it had any benefit. But then in June, this study came out, oral THC improves symptoms of schizophrenia. So it's it depends. When I get a negative report on anything, I start looking for the rebuttal to that report, which is usually on Normal's website. Paul Armentano.
Or who funded it?
Exactly, who funded it? That's the very first question. Who funded it? It almost always had some kind of government money. But this particular thing did show a big improvement in the patients using cannabis. But I mentioned the recent study. This came out March 1st. This is the negative thing that you'll see. This got a lot of press. It was all over the internet. It was, reported in newspapers. Pot smoking increases risks of psychosis. So right off the bat, next day, I go to Normal's website, and here is the rebuttal to it, which is beautiful. And it quotes this article. So this came out March 1st. This was actually even ahead of that. So this was in February, the middle of last month. It said, and so it was before this was even on the newsstand. And this was published in the Journal of Addiction. Supposed marijuana and schizophrenia link overstated. So it gives now a lot of references within this article as to where you can look to just see where they've overstated this association. That's all it is. It's a possible association, especially they talk about kids that start heavy cannabis use as teenagers. They haven't been able to find it in anyone else. And if there is a statistical association, they don't know if the disease caused the use of cannabis or the cannabis caused they like to think the cannabis caused it, but it's such a tiny, tiny fraction of patients that might even fall into this category that it hasn't reached any kind of significance because, for instance, you see the incidence and prevalence of schizophrenia and psychosis were either stable or declining during the period that they're looking at it. So, and there hasn't been any increase in schizophrenia in the general population. In fact, there's been a slight decline. Yeah.
NPR just had a study out, or an article out on the teenage brain, though, mm-hmm. and how, because it's in the process of formation,
right,
that there's not a connection between the frontal lobe. And they actually referenced that medical marijuana alters the connectors up there mm-hmm. for the teenage brain, just
yeah.
because it's not formed in a way that it doesn't to adult brains.
Yeah, I think it's really very good to be cautious about any kind of drug therapy in children. In fact, that goes for Ritalin and all the other kinds of things that people are giving kids. But in some cases, like with this child and cases of ADD, it may you have to look at the risk ratio, benefit ratio, and taking a risk where there may be a tiny risk in a teenage brain and forming, whatever is going to happen in the future, but it may be an overwhelming reason to use cannabis if they have a situation that could benefit from it. The safety of cannabis is also something that people have looked at, and our government always tries to tell us that it's so unsafe. But this particular graph, which I know it's probably a little hard to see from where you're sitting, but it was done by the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, as well as UC San Francisco. So these are very reputable sources. And here's cannabis over here. They're looking at nicotine, heroin, cocaine, alcohol, caffeine, and cannabis. Cannabis is low on everything except for the intoxication. It's not the same as nicotine or caffeine. It doesn't cause any kind of intoxication. But if you're looking at intoxication levels compared to heroin, cocaine, and alcohol, it's lower than any of those. So it's safer in all these different parameters of possible what would be looked at as addictive potentials of any drug. As Christine mentioned earlier, there is no LD50 or lethal dose known for cannabis.
Mm-hmm. I'm a lactation consultant, and in my training, mm-hmm. I asked, there were all kinds of studies done on alcohol and breast milk and how it affects kids, and I wanted to know if there was any studies for THC, and she said there was one. She didn't want to talk about it. And so after class, I said, well, what's up with this study? And she goes, well, the babies whose mothers smoked, you were smarter, and she said they ate better. And I don't know what that was about. I don't know if it was healthier. Maybe it was just like growing me.
Well, maybe with the sucking, nursing, because that does seem to be enhanced with kids that are exposed to THC.
Fatter.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. They were smarter.
Yeah. Well, Melanie Dreyer out of I think it's the University of Indiana or Ohio, one of those Midwestern universities. She did her PhD thesis on cannabis smoking in pregnant women. And it was she did it in Jamaica. And it's she's really a great expert. And if you Googled her name on you'd be able to listen to some of her lectures. And this is all about use of cannabis in pregnant women and babies later on. Melanie Dreyer, and I've heard her speak a few times, and she is just it's just so great. And really, all the kids, they've been following the kids in her studies for many years, and they're just they do very, very well. They have no impairment at all, and they do better in most everything.
You know, from my understanding of the, I read some stuff online about it, and the children that came up actually excelled and were healthier than the kids that were taking nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, that was pretty amazing.
It's sad because so many doctors won't, you know, they'll even take babies away from people that have been smoking cannabis because, of course, you know, you can do a urine test and see. And it's just really sad that it's come to that because especially for hyperemesis gravidarum, which is excessive vomiting during pregnancy, it's sometimes the only thing that will work and keep babies, you know, in utero and not have a lot of premature, low birth weight babies. This one, I really loved this study from UCSD. This was in August. Looked at binge drinking in college kids. This is done through UCSD and San Diego State. And they had a definition for binge drinking, quite a few drinks in one period of time. And they looked at the brain matter of kids that had the binge drinking. In 8 different brain cell regions, they had white cell damage. But the kids that smoked cannabis and drank at the same time had protection in 7 of the 8 areas of the brain.
A brief look on the web confirms there is indeed a lot of medical information about positive effects of cannabis. So why is this not widely known? Well, the corporate media structure is responsive to money. And let's think about the financial incentives involved. Drug companies don't want natural medicines because, of course, they can't make money from them. They tend to have fewer side effects. That knocks into other medicine sales. The war on drugs is used politically by governments to roll back people's civil liberties, to put people in a state of fear, and, of course, to make a lot of money. How many people are in the US incarcerated on nonviolent drugs charges? Isn't it about 1 million? So in the same way, as Gatto said, schools test obedience by inventing junk tests and seeing which kids swat up for those tests, society has made a junk law to make illegal something which is beneficial and say those people who break this law are the people who we should outlaw. By discrediting these people as drug users, their values are suppressed, and there's 1 million or so disobedient people taken out of U.S. society through the drug laws. There's the trafficking industry. A lot of drug cartels, CIA, make a lot of money from trafficking drugs. They make that off the books, so it goes into the black budget. They can use it for whatever purposes they feel like without disclosing it. The role of the CIA in drug trafficking, of course, well documented. Just go to Wikipedia. But barely known by Americans, and events like the handling of the Iran-Contra scandal show just how institutional forces line up behind hiding what is really going on. I think the fact that cannabis treats depression is a reason why people who sell to depressed people don't want it, advertisers, people who sell them entertainment. We're going to hear in our second hour from Michael Pollan on other reasons. He calls cannabis a cultural mutagen. So to summarize, there are large institutional forces with a vested interest in preserving the status quo. They don't want cannabis. There's a lot of individuals on the other side, especially those with medical complaints, who would like to use this drug to alleviate them.